From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on June 26, 2013, when the U.S. Supreme Court handed down its decision in what became a landmark case in the fight for LGBTQ rights. United States v. Windsor brought the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, of 1996 to the center of the nation's attention. Edie Windsor and her longtime partner, Thea Speier, had their marriage recognized by New York State in 2008. When Thea died a year later, Windsor inherited her entire estate. But what happened next changed history. When Windsor sought to claim the federal estate tax exemption for spouses, Section 3 of DOMA prevented her from doing so. The act barred same-sex married couples from being recognized as spouses by the federal government. And that meant Windsor had to pay more than $360,000 in taxes, a huge penalty. So Windsor sued. And in 2013, affirming the decision of two lower courts, the Supreme Court overturned the law citing the Fifth Amendment, which guarantees no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The decision invalidated DOMA, making same-sex partners eligible for the same benefits accorded to married heterosexuals. But there was a catch. The ruling did not cover if there was a constitutional right to same-sex unions. So those federal benefits only applied to gay couples in states that recognize same-sex marriage. At the time, that included 13 states and the District of Columbia. While the ruling fell short of the change that activists wanted to see, Windsor became a national celebrity. She met with President Barack Obama, who called himself a huge fan of hers. She was the Grand Marshal of the New York City LGBT Pride March, and she was the runner-up for Time Magazine's Person of the Year in 2013, coming in right behind Pope Francis. Her case paved the way for Jim Obergefell's case in 2015, which legalized same-sex marriage in all 50 states. In 2016, Windsor remarried, and her wife, Judith Kaysen Windsor, has been a powerful LGBTQ rights advocate for decades and is a respected financial advisor. She's traveling the country to share her late wife's legacy, and today she's in Rochester for an event with Assemblymember Harry Bronson. She joins us this hour to share Windsor's journey from hiding her sexual identity for many years to becoming a national civil rights icon and discussing the state of LGBTQ rights in the country today. Judith, we are honored to have you. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Also with us, Assemblymember Harry Bronson. Back with us. Nice to have you as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Evelyn Bailey is here. Evelyn is executive producer of the Shoulders to Stand On documentary, among so many other titles we could give you. But it's great to have you as always, Evelyn. Thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, Evelyn, as someone who always learns a lot of history from you, Edie Windsor is a name that more Americans should probably know right off the top of their head, shouldn't it?
They should, but they don't. And that's why we're here, and that's why Judith has brought the book to public eye, and you have to read it.
It's beautiful. Producer Megan Mack and I were tearing through it. The book is called A Wild and Precious Life, a memoir by Edie Windsor with the help of Joshua Lyon. It's a phenomenal story. It is a life story. It's a story of her personal identity, but also her work career and how it culminated with her work for civil rights, becoming a national celebrity. You know, Judith, when you first met her, the book kind of gives us some of it, but why don't you tell me a little bit about first meeting your late wife?
First meeting her?
Yeah.
I actually met Edie and Thea at a Callan Lord event, just randomly, and that was about 3 months before Thea passed away. Mm-hmm. And they were, you know, they were a presence everywhere they went. And I just remember, I don't remember meeting Edie at that moment, but I do remember meeting Thea because she had this Rolls Royce of a wheelchair. And so I do remember meeting her. Fast forward about 9 months later, Edie got the Lifetime Achievement Award at SAGE. And I don't know what it was, but I looked across the room of 1,000 people as she accepted this award and gave this speech. And I don't know. I don't know how to.
There was something electric there?
Yeah. Yeah, Edie just had this whole, just vibrant, just, she was just amazing. She was just absolutely amazing.
By the last several years of her life, how comfortable was she with what became her celebrity?
Oh, she loved it. She had so much fun with it. We had,
because people would chant her name at the
event. Oh, yeah. I say this all the time. Traveling around with Edie Windsor was like traveling around with Beyonce. It was insanity. You're right. People would chant her name. We would go into, you know, an event with, you know, 1,000 people at, you know, Shipping on East Wall Street or whatever, and we would have to get security to, like, create a tunnel for her to get to her table. Like, to get her from the cocktail hour to the dinner was nearly impossible. Like, we'd have to build the tunnel and do all this stuff. We also couldn't go anywhere on the street. We couldn't go to Washington Square Park. We couldn't go to Bed Bath & Beyond. We couldn't go to the grocery store. I mean, she was recognized in Manhattan everywhere. And one of my favorite stories is in June 2017, we went to this kind of famous restaurant in New York. It's called Knickerbocker's, and it's like right around the corner from us. And we went, and as we were leaving, there were, you know, they had these booths that are sort of half, and they kind of face the restaurant. Mm-hmm. Well, there were three, I would assume, gay guys, you know, sitting there. And as Edie walked by, one of them gasped and was like, "Oh my God, that's Edie Windsor." And I stopped. You know, Edie was about, you know, 5-10 feet ahead of me, and I stopped and I said, "Do you want to meet her?" They're like, "No way, can we?" And I said, "Sure." So Edie turned around and saw that I had stopped, so she came back and she, you know, spoke to them and, like, you know, kissed their cheeks and did her usual thing that she did. And then the table behind us was about 12 people, and one of them said, "Oh my God, that's Edie Windsor." And they all stood up and started clapping. And then the entire restaurant stood up and started to clap. And then everyone sort of, like, you know, maybe 30 tables over, were like, who's there? Who's over there? And it was Edie Windsor.
Awesome story.
Because yeah. They're like, I mean, but that was a very typical day. A very typical day.
She passed away at the age of 88. Mm-hmm. But I think I was surprised to find out in the book that her passing was not expected.
No, not at all.
This is not a case of, you know, sort of a difficult decline.
No.
And I am so sorry about that.
It was very difficult for everybody. For the whole New York community who knew her so well for so long. I mean, she was our rock. Mm-hmm. You know, she was such a force in our community. And it was a real shock to all of us.
No, we just marked, Assemblymember Bronson, we just marked 50 years since the Stonewall riots. And, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of work that's being done in communities like Rochester across the country to make sure that we understand our history. I grew up not learning about Stonewall in textbooks. I don't know if future generations will read Edie's name or not, because history moves pretty quickly. How much impact has this woman had on our country, the fabric of our country? What do you want people to know when they hear her name?
Yeah, she's had tremendous impact. The book talks a little bit about it. The organizations that she worked with, you know, she helped fund organizations. She helped to start up organizations. But as we relate it to the book, as I read that book, I was reading my life's journey too. Mm-hmm. Being closeted in a law firm, you know, starting to come out to people. Her one section where, I can't remember the friend's name, but just tell me where the lesbians are. Take me to where the lesbians are. I mean, so many of us have gone through that. So I think this book has an individual's journey that many people in the LGBTQ community can relate to. And those who aren't in the community need to understand that. And it's easier to understand it through a person's personal human life than just Stonewall happened 50 years ago. Marriage equality in New York happened in June 2011. We got full rights across the country in 2013. I mean, it's more than just those dates. It is a journey that individuals went through, and a journey that our culture, our community went through. So that's what I want people to take from this book, and that's what I want to be taught in our schools, either through this book or other ways, is, you know, what is the LGBTQ culture, and how do we identify as such?
So listeners know that we do a lot of books on the show throughout the year, and there's some great books, and there's some books that you read and you go, okay, I learned something not all that well written. This is a beautifully written book that reads like a, you know, sort of a dramatic work of fiction, but it's real. The book is called A Wild and Precious Life, and I guarantee you, if you pick it up, you're probably going to rip through it. And one of the things that will allow me to do this hour with our, all three of our guests is talk about where we have come from, where we are now, and where we are perhaps yet to go. So I want to explore a couple of themes there. First of all, you know, Edie talked about the way in her life she understood what she might be allowed to do as moving into her adulthood, or what society would allow versus what her heart wanted. You know, she married a man, but even before that, she had this experience in which her boyfriend, she's dating a man, and he is close with another guy who's dating a woman. I think her name was Caroline, if I remember. Is that
a name that's
change for the book?
Yeah, protect the innocent.
Change for the book. But she falls hard for Caroline, who is the girlfriend of, you know. So there are these two couples, and they're hanging out together, and they're doing all of these things together. And she is basically creating whatever space she can to have romantic and even sexual experiences with Caroline, knowing that she cannot, or at least in her own mind, she can't really pursue that even if she wants to, carrying on the charade of being in a heterosexual relationship, and ultimately then having to break it off and crying in public with this woman who was kind of challenging her a little bit to, you know, do you have to do this? And it's just heartbreaking to read this. How common is that scenario in the past versus maybe even the present? Can I ask all three? Evelyn?
It's still present today, mm-hmm. because we have, because of the political climate, gone back to having to be more afraid of being out, of being visible, of identifying as LGBTQ, and especially for trans men and women. That dichotomy leaves two different worlds that we have to travel in. And many people in the past created alter lives that they shared at work. Edie did with Willie. Because when you go to lunch around, you know, at work, and you sit around the table and you talk about what you did on the weekend, what do you say? I went to the club with my girlfriend, and then we had, you know, sex afterwards? No, you can't do that. So the closet and the need to be acceptable and not be identified was the way people lived almost totally in the 1970s. And then with the onslaught of AIDS in the 1980s, as much as possible. Today, we've moved back to being more afraid. Young people don't have this sense of, I'll somehow die. They'll live forever, and they don't think anything is ever going to happen to them. And they're never going to be ostracized. They're never going to be, you know, pushed out. Except when you're LGBTQ, you may or may not be accepted by your family, by your friends. If you're trans, the same thing is true, and more true for the trans person. Elderly LGBTQ men and women are frightened again by this onslaught of political rhetoric that denies them the right to be who they are with dignity, justice, and equality. And until that changes, the freedom to be who you are, whatever age you are, is not really going to take hold. I mean, the process, Harry and Judith can both speak to the process. You got to come out to yourself. Then you got to come out to the people you know and who say they love you, and hopefully that doesn't change. It's a scary, risky thing. It just doesn't happen. what Edie was able to do, or Josh was able to do in the book, was to bring a sense of reality to that experience that was personal, reflected the time and the duality of having to present one way and live, or try to live, another way.
Assemblymember Bronson?
Yeah, I think that we've come a long way. And it, in some ways, the community's more supportive. We have organizations that are more supportive. And so we do have that aspect of it. But we are, you know, I think certainly with Edie in the 50s was very different than me coming out in the 90s. But when I came out in the 90s, I didn't use the word gay with my mom because I didn't even think she would understand what that meant. So I used the word homosexual because I knew she knew what that meant. You know, that was a time we didn't have the Sexual Orientation Non-Discrimination Act. You know, I was in a law firm where I was told if other partners find out you're gay, there will be no place for you in this firm. Though what Edie experienced and what's put forth in this wonderful book, you know, is something that I think still exists, maybe to a less degree as the decades went from 50 to 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. But then we have, you know, a federal government that is attacking the LGBTQ community. We have an increase in hate crimes that includes LGBTQ folks. We have a federal government that's pushing the religious exemption rights so that you know, in this day and age, if you're a person of color, you're not going to be denied service at a diner. But if you're a gay person, you can be denied having a wedding cake baked by a baker. The times have gotten better, but we have a lot of fights that we're going to have to continue to endure.
Judah, how do you see that personal story that she shared, even just the Caroline story, and whether that has changed enough, I guess, and how perhaps you see it reflected in different ways?
I don't think it has changed that much. I'll be honest. You know, Edie came out in the early 1950s. I can't even imagine what that was like. Like, you know, like Harry said, there was no words except for homosexual or deviant, you know. And there's a part in the book where she, you know, goes to, you know, a therapy group, not conversion therapy, but it was a therapy group. And you had these, you know, sexual dysfunction people and philanderers and all this other stuff. And this group focused on Edie. They thought Edie had the biggest problem.
I think at one point,
out of everybody.
Saying, well, you know, it's not that you're homosexual. You just want, you know, a matriarchal figure.
Right.
That's what you really need.
Yeah. And, you know, we've all heard that. They're like, you just haven't met the right guy yet. But what I found interesting is, you know, Edie, you know, when I can't imagine coming out and being what she did and what her and Thea did in such a patriarchal society in the 1960s and her getting that diamond pin and doing, I can't even wrap my head around it. Then, you know, I kind of came out in the 90s and I led a very similar life. You know, my personal life and my professional life was very separate. And then actually I have a friend from college that I've known for over 30 years, and she has a son who is 13 years old. And we've known for a very long time he is gay. And she said he takes on different personalities with different groups of friends. And so here we have almost a 90-year span. And this kid at 13 can't quite come out at 13. And you know, she says he acts like himself around certain groups of people, and he acts a different way around other people.
Does that break your heart?
It does break my heart because I've known him since the day he was born. It absolutely breaks my heart.
He's 13 and struggling to
and
feel
struggling.
Like in certain
settings. He hasn't quite told her yet. And the other thing is, like, you know, also, you know, with Edie coming out, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, people were scared, really scared, you know, for your life and for, you know, like, you know, when they talk about how they raided bars, you know, that's just a sentence. It goes deeper than that. They raided the bars. They arrested them. They put their names in the newspaper. They completely humiliated you and outed you. And your life was destroyed. And then there's all these other random things. You know, and Edie carried a lot of those fears through her entire life. I tell people, like, when I used to come home from work and I walked into the apartment and, you know, went over to give her a kiss hello, and if the blinds were open, she flipped out. She's like, stop it, get away from me. She'd run over.
Even then?
Close the blinds. Yes.
Wow.
Close the blinds, and then she would kiss me hello. And I recently had a thing where I walked into the apartment, and it was, you know, very, it was after an event, it was very quiet and very lonely. And I was like, I said, oh my God. I said, her and Thea lived in this apartment for 50 years in fear.
So to Evelyn's point about coming out, you come out mm-hmm. to yourself, then you may come out to friends or family, and then you've got to deal with work and society. So Edie had this. To me, the story of IBM was very interesting because Edie was a brilliant woman and
beyond brilliant,
working her way through IBM yeah. and described IBM when it came to women in the workplace as quite progressive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're talking decades ago, and IBM was, you know, willing to have women rise through the ranks, et cetera. So that was, you know, you hit that part and you go, oh, you know, well, that's good for them. Interesting. And yet she still felt like she had to date men at the office or sort of appear to date men in the office to keep up the appearance at IBM, this ostensible bastion of progressivism that she was a heterosexual. And that's hard to square. How does that square with your experience on Wall Street and how you decided to kind of approach being out on Wall Street?
I wasn't out for the first 13 years that I was on Wall Street, and it wasn't until I moved to a different firm. And at the time, I was living with someone, and we had joint accounts and, you know, things like that. So I just, I mean, I wouldn't say I made a big announcement, but slowly but surely, you know, I think people around the office, you know, started to know.
And this was in the 90s?
This would be in 2008.
Wow. And so were you nervous about doing that?
I mean, I was out.
Personally?
Personally.
Sure. But on Wall Street,
at work,
not out.
Not at all.
Were you nervous about that?
No.
By then you were not?
Yeah, by then I was not. I was old enough and, you know, things are different. And again, it's not like I had to broadcast it.
Sure.
Or put a big, like, pride flag on my office or, you know, do anything like that. You know, I didn't make an announcement or anything, but I just didn't hide it either.
Yeah, go ahead, Evelyn. Yeah.
I think there's a difference. Mm-hmm. The corporate culture that Judith worked in and that Edie worked in was a culture that was much more interested in what you could produce, how you could affect the bottom line, what made a difference to the company, that the quality, education, experience, whatever that you had that contributed to their success. It was actually Lim DeKonak here in Rochester that made that the bottom line for going to management and saying, we need an employee resource group. The African American workers at Kodak were the first group to have an employee resource group. The LGBTQ workers were the second. I also think there's a huge difference in status. To work on Wall Street, I'm sure there are people who are not really qualified to be there, but if you're there and you're successful, you have a status that supports difference, that supports individuality.
Because you make money?
Because you make money and you make money for them.
Yeah, for the firm.
Yeah. When you work in a smaller group or a smaller like retail or sales or...
Amy Stevens.
Go ahead.
Amy Stevens, who worked in a funeral home, is a very prime example.
They're not valued because their contribution anyone could make. You could... There are hundreds of English teachers who have a degree in English and want to teach. The jobs are few and far between in that field. If you get a job as a teacher, you better not imply, suggest, give any idea that you're LGBTQ. We have a whole group of GSAs, Gay Straight Alliances, in this community in high schools. The advisors of those groups are often frightened to suggest activities or to do things that would make visible homosexuality, being gay, being a lesbian, and in some of the groups, the students are closeted. They will not come out to friends, anyone at school, or their families. They only have that small support group. Hmm. So the closet is not a 1940, 1950, 1960 experience. It is an experience that's lived by many today. It's more prevalent, I believe, and Harry can probably speak to this more than I, in rural America versus urban America.
I think that's an important point because, and so let me turn to our guests on this side of the table for a couple of points on this. It would probably be a mistake, Judith, to ask if in the modern American economy it's, quote, okay to be gay or if it's okay to be out. Because on Wall Street, again, it's sort of a different experience than in a lot of different places. Is that a fair distinction to make right now?
Yes.
Okay. And what is it going to then take where no matter the sector, the work, the location, you can be out and you can work and it's not going to be an issue? Is that a cultural? I mean, is that political? Where do we go? What do we do to get there?
I think it's a combination of a couple of cultural and political and religious. And there's a couple things and several things going on because, you know, LGBT youth, that's 40% of the homeless youth on the street is LGBTQ. Mm-hmm. Edie and I were passionate about that. There's no other culture or color of skin or religion or no one gets kicked out of their house. The only child that gets kicked out of their house and shunned from their family is LGBTQ. Nobody gets kicked out because they have green eyes or blue eyes or light skin, dark skin. Only LGBTQ youth get...
By their own family.
By their own families. And, you know, and we experienced that in the 80s with the AIDS crisis. I mean, families left their sons to die. Didn't visit them in the hospital. Didn't claim their bodies. They were ashamed. And so there's a certain amount of shame sort of, you know, associated with being LGBTQ as opposed to, you know, some other groups.
Yeah, and so, you know, Harry, when we talk about sort of the cliche that justice doesn't move in a straight line, do you agree with Evelyn that this is one of those moments that at least in the last several years, this American moment for this particular community in this country has been gone backwards a bit?
Yeah, I think it's for other minority groups as well.
Yeah, you're sure, sure.
But certainly, I think we are in a moment of time that, you know, we've passed significant pieces of legislation. We have rights in the workplace. But keep in mind, most LGBTQ folks across this country do not have anti-discrimination rights in the workplace. And so we've done some of that. Now, I think our mission as activists needs to be, how do we create a better awareness? How do we create a better understanding? How do we have folks step back and look at the dignity that's inherent in all of us and start from that place. Instead of starting from the place of you're a gay person or a trans person. And then, you know, how people step back and ask themselves, what are the stereotypes that I'm applying to this person because I just found out they're gay? You know, what does that mean? And so our work is long from being done. And, you know, the Supreme Court has helped us a lot. We don't know if that's certain. You know, there's going to be more appointments to the Supreme Court, probably, given the age of some of the members currently. And although very good decisions with the Windsor decision and the other decision after that, but it doesn't mean that a very conservative Supreme Court can't change that. So, but in the meantime, I think it's up to all of us who have been involved in our civil rights, if you will, for decades, to help move us toward how do we make cultural changes at this point.
So before I get to your phone calls, Don, Rich on the phone, hang there for 1 second. I just want to follow up with Judith on one other, I think, an important point here. We're going to remember Edie Windsor's name for the Supreme Court case that got decided in 2013. And again, listeners, if you're just joining us, Edie Windsor passed away at the age of 88 a couple of years ago now. And her widow is with us this hour. In fact, Judith is visiting Rochester.
Surviving spouse.
Surviving spouse. Thank you. Visiting Rochester and doing an event with Harry Bronson tonight. It's all RSVP'd out. Sorry to tell you that. That's how popular it is. But Edie Windsor took that case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court because when her wife died, they had gotten married in Canada in 2007, if I remember correctly.
That is correct.
Recognized by New York State in 2008. 2009, Thea dies, and the federal government tells Edie, you can't inherit all of this. We're going to hammer you on the taxes because your marriage didn't count. So they take it to the Supreme Court, and they win. Edie wins in 2013. And then within 2 years, we see same-sex marriage recognized. I think it's fair to say that without the Windsor case, that probably doesn't happen either. Right. These dominoes exist.
That's correct.
Did you talk to, did you ever ask her, were you surprised that you won the 2013? Did she expect to win that case?
I think initially, no. Mm-hmm. But as time went on, because, like, you know, we in New York City, you know, we knew about this in 2010 because she did, like, her first, you know, press conference at the LGBT Center. And so we knew about it. But I don't think the country sort of caught on to it until probably 2012 and the oral arguments, which were in March, and then the decision came down in June 26th. I forgot your question.
I was asking if she expected to win that. And you're saying that by what had happened before then, it seemed like there was some momentum.
There was definitely momentum.
Yeah.
And what happened, I'm sorry, just spaced on that because I was thinking about 12 other stories that I could tell you. But what happened was, and this is where this bond with her and Barack Obama came from, was, you know, it was Barack Obama that came out with Eric Holder. And they said, you know, this lady's right. We owe her this money. Mm-hmm. And Barack Obama and Eric Holder said, we will no longer defend this law. And that's when it became Windsor versus United States to United States versus Windsor. And, you know, she has a couple of, you know, interviews where she says, like, when she saw that in print, that the United States government was then suing her, it kind of blew her away. You know, so it was really, that was the momentum. And it was really Barack Obama and Eric Holder who came out and said, we can no longer defend this law. I also want to talk about, you know, you mentioned that, you know, there were two other steps to that.
Yeah.
And not only, you know, everybody knows she pays $363,000 federally. She also paid $275,000 in New York State. A lot of people don't know that. Hmm. So she paid New York State taxes and federal taxes. And we still have the same accountant today. and I live in Manhattan, and he lives in Yonkers. And I asked him this question one day. I said, what was it like to make that phone call to Edie Windsor and tell her she owed 275 state and 363 federal? And he goes, you know, that's client, you know, privilege. I can't get into a lot of detail or whatever. But he said, he goes, I'll tell you this. I live in Yonkers, and I'm not sure if I heard Edie screaming from out my window, or if it was on the phone. She was furious.
It's because of Edie Windsor.
It was just so, just to her core, to her very being, that how much she loved this country and believed in justice and believed in equality, that, you know, even if she was married to a man for a day, she would not have these issues. Not one of these issues. And she just could not stomach it, that this country would not recognize the woman that she lived with and loved for 44 years as her legal spouse.
Well, it's interesting that today, for so many of us, you hear this kind of story and you think, well, that's absurd. It's logical. They were married. Of course, they're afforded the same protections and benefits. But it was 2013. That's not that long ago.
6 years.
Edie Windsor is one of the reasons that not only that case, but then you get national recognition of equal marriage. And so it is her memoir, A Wild and Precious Life, that is out now. Harry, you want to add something before we go to break here? Okay, well, there's so much to talk about. We could do this all day. And I promise this. I'm going to ask Edie Windsor's surviving spouse before the hour's up to share her favorite Edie story. But let's get our only break of the hour. We'll take a few phone calls as well right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, Monroe County Sheriff Todd Baxter recently wrote an op-ed for the Democrat and Chronicle in which he called for the state to reverse its bail reform measure. Baxter says the legislation could lead to unintended consequences when it comes to issues related to safety, addiction, and more. He joins us to talk about it. Then in our second hour, we discuss the growth and impact of international baccalaureate programs in local schools. Talk with you Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me get Don in East Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I really think that Edith Windsor is easily comparable to in the LGBTQ community to Rosa Parks, because she was I think yesterday was Rosa Parks' birthday, and it was being celebrated around the nation. Anyway, it was recently, and I think Edie Windsor is comparable to Rosa Parks. But I have one pet peeve about this whole thing, and that is that every time I hear the term, this is my wife, this is my husband, it makes me cringe, because when I came out of the closet in the late 60s and early 70s was a militant period in the lesbian and gay community. And we thought that these absurd heterosexist sex roles were damaging, were demeaning. Now I see that we're copying them. I don't have a husband, because if I have a husband, that implies that I'm the wife. If I say I'm the husband, that implies he's the wife. These are sex roles that have to be destroyed, and I don't see why the community is embracing them. I would much rather hear the word spouse, and it's a perfectly good, but you don't have to invent it. It's already in the English language. I want to see a commitment or an aggressive push in this community to start referring to ourselves as spouses, not husband or not wife, because these are absurd, obsolete sex roles that should have been gone a long time ago, and it doesn't seem like they're. I do not want to copy what I see as oppressive from the heterosexual community. Also, I would like to say, regarding the present situation, both in Washington and in the United States, we need to fight like hell, just like the rebels at Stonewall fought back. And that wasn't in a vacuum. A lot of other things were going on in the United States at the same time, which aren't going on now. We need to fight back. We need to take over. Even if it takes throwing rocks in a bar window, that's what we need to do to
to get what we need.
Don, thank you. As always, appreciate the phone call. So let's talk about that terminology. Does the term wife bother you?
It doesn't bother me. Okay. And Don, bravo. Because Edie and Thea, especially Thea, was insulted to be called a wife.
Hmm.
They used the term spouses. So yeah. Edie and I used the term spouses. Then in the next part, I'm very close. Larry Kramer randomly lives in my building, and I talk to him quite a bit. And we have discussed recently that, you know, we have the kids from Parkland High School, you know, out there, you know, with, you know, gun control.
Doing their advocacy. Yeah.
Doing their advocacy. There's Greta Thunberg with,
yep.
with climate change.
Climate action, yep.
We don't have a face to the LGBT community. Who is our young person?
And the youth side, yeah.
Who is that person? Because, you know, we've done it. I've been doing this for a long time. You know, I'm a little tired.
Is that the media's fault, though? I'm serious. I mean, is that...
Well, it goes back to the whole thing of that, you know, LGBT is still, you know, in a different category. It's still shameful. It's very difficult for an 18 or a 19-year-old to be that spokesperson for us. And then, you know, when we go back at our age and talk to these young people about an Edie Windsor or a Larry Kramer, and we talk to them about the age crisis, it's an anomaly to them. And they don't take it as seriously. You know, and they just feel like they're getting lectured. But, you know, there is a very serious AIDS epidemic today. We don't have that spokesperson.
Yeah, go ahead, Evelyn. Yeah.
I think in terms of the first question, male, female, husband, wife,
yeah.
Today's youth are much more fluid in their sexual identity. Cisgender.
Non-binary.
Binary. They have created a language that I have to read the definitions of in order to understand what they're talking about. Once I read them, oh, I get it. I understand. I know the difference. So they are doing it. I don't know how widespread across the country that is, but they're doing it in Rochester. The other thing about what you were just talking about, AIDS is not over, as you know. December 1st was World AIDS Day. Young people are not being tested because they feel it's a chronic disease that when they show symptoms, they'll get tested, they'll get treatment, and they'll be fine for the next 40 years. No one knows the long-term effect of all of that treatment. But you still have people and families that will not allow their children to be LGBTQ. That's why Elaine Spall has a new homeless youth shelter mm-hmm. for LGBTQ kids in this community. And, you know, what I look at that, what Edie did, she had a sense of pride in herself. She had a sense of her own goodness and her own strength, because that's what gave her the ability to say, I'm not going to compromise or be less of an honest person than I am just to please, just to fit in, just to be accepted. She had character and an ethics that was like the steel rod my grandmother, who's Italian, had. It went right through her, and it wasn't going to bend. And that says a whole lot about women, and we can't forget, Edie is one woman. How many other women have done extraordinary things and been ordinary women who haven't been recognized, who haven't been identified as an icon because they haven't gone up against the Supreme Court, or they haven't sued somebody, or they haven't whatever.
And that's why I think, you know, I wonder if the media, you know, amplifies certain voices but not others. I'm just, I don't know, but I think it's an interesting point. Let me grab one more phone call in New York. This is Donna. Hi, Donna. Are you there, Donna? Let me try that again.
Hello.
Oh, that's my fault. Go ahead, Donna. Do that again. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm calling with respect to Judith. I am so sorry for your loss.
It is all of our loss.
No, it's all of us. I love Dee Dee. I used to go to the party in Southampton at her home.
Oh, yes. Dee Dee's backyard barbecue.
Woman.
Yes.
Wonderful woman, and I'm so sorry for your loss now, but I didn't understand the cause of her passing. Could you elaborate at all on that?
One, that's Edie's Backyard Barbecue, and it is the Saturday of Memorial Day weekend, and I have continued that tradition. Her and Thea did that for 25 or 30 years, and now they have renamed the HIV and AIDS Center at Southampton Hospital as the Edie Windsor Center. So that is the beneficiary for the Edie's Backyard Barbecue. Also, in regards to AIDS, and I'll get to your question in one second.
Yeah, yeah.
In regards to AIDS, you know, it is such a stigmatized disease, and it's considered, you know, a gay man's disease, that 60% of the new AIDS cases in America today, African-American women.
Yeah,
and it is still stigmatized as a gay man's health crisis, for lack of a better word. To answer your question about Edie, there wasn't. You know, that's the beauty of Edie. You know, you met her, you saw how she was vibrant, and she was alive, and she was, you know, strong, and she walked with, you know, swagger, and that's just how she was. And, you know, I think Josh.
I met you at one of the parties, and I got to see how happy she was.
Yeah,
it was beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. We had a lot of fun together. We were, you know, Edie and I kind of joked about it that, you know, we squeezed 10 years into, you know, a little over two. You know, we were extremely, extremely close, and that's how I know this. You know, all this stuff about Edie. I think Josh explained it extremely well, that it was just, you know, a woman that, you know, her, you know, her body wanted some rest.
Yeah. Right.
You know, because, you know, you have to think, you know, when the case started, you know, she was 83 years old. So from 83 to 85, you can't even imagine what our life was like. I mean, yes, actually you can. If you've been to his backyard barbecue, you know, yeah, you saw how she moved through a crowd and whatever. That was our every day.
Well,
right.
Yeah, which was wonderful.
She
I mean,
called
there,
me
there
one
could,
time
there,
because I had thanked her for, you know, how she said hello to every guest.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And she made everybody feel so welcomed. And it was just nice at the end, the last time I attended, to see her so happy.
Yeah.
And to enjoy having her, you know, her person in her life there with her.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry for your loss.
Yep. And I'm actually very similar to that. I was telling the story yesterday because, you know, Pam Carlin spoke. And she had given Edie a coffee mug with a bunch of pictures, you know, from the Supreme Court. And when Pam Carlin wrote something about the, you know, when Edie passed away, she wrote something about the coffee mug, and I sent Pam Carlin that coffee mug.
In our last 90 seconds or so, any other stories you want to share from Edie to leave with us?
90 seconds or less. you know, Edie was, you know, she was the perfect plaintiff. Not only was she the perfect plaintiff, she was like the perfect person. Like, Edie just, she just had it. She just had all this glamour and gravitas and just everything that came out of her mouth used to just blow me away. Just absolutely blow me away. Just had this, you know, just had this wisdom about her. And it really came from her childhood. You know, she had this self-esteem from her mother. I do like to talk about, you know, because, again, I think these are just sentences. When somebody says, oh, the Stonewall riots, that's one thing. You know, they said, you know, Edie was, you know, earned the highest technical rank at IBM. You know, I don't know if I have enough time to get into this, but, like, you know, I equate it to, and this is exactly what she was doing. If you saw the movie Hidden Figures, what those women were doing at NASA, mm-hmm. Edie was doing the exact same thing with the Energy Atomic Commission in New York. Like, that's how instrumental Edie was at IBM.
I'm not surprised to hear that. Hey, Assembly Member, in 20 seconds, we've talked gender in the past and other issues. Any legislative priorities, or is this mostly cultural work now to make change happen?
No, legislative priorities. I'm chair of the Aging Committee in the Assembly. We have a bill that the governor is looking at right now that would require LGBTQ cultural sensitive awareness in any of the services that we provide for our older LGBT New Yorkers.
Okay, and we'll be following that. Keep us up to date on that. And I just want to thank our guests. Judith Kaysen Windsor is the surviving spouse of the great Edie Windsor. Thank you for sharing her story and yours with us this hour.
Thank you for having us.
The book, by the way, is called A Wild and Precious Life, a Memoir. And it is a gripping read. Always great to learn from Evelyn Bailey. Thank you for taking the time to be here this hour. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
And Assembly Member Harry Bronson, have a nice time tonight with the event with Judith. Again, listeners, I'd tell you more, but it's pretty much sold out. But thank you, Harry. It's always nice to see you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Evan.
Our thanks to the entire Connections team today. Josephine, thanks for the great work. And Megan Mack is the producer. Rob Braden is the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.